Welcome to For the Love of Dogs with Dennis Wolf.
And welcome to For the Love of Dog with Janice Wolf. And remember, later on in the show, we're going to have our segment on From Shelter Dog to Service Dog. So today, we're going to start talking about some of the common issues that happen in the spring and summer. Now, if you're in the Northeast and most of the country, you know there's been really bad rains. It's been pretty much torrential downpours. So what's starting to happen is a lot of dogs who normally wouldn't have issues are going outside. They get things on their paws, like, let's say, just a little bit of dirt or an animal's feces or urine that they're just walking on the street. So a good idea right now, even if you've never done it before, is actually getting some kind of antibacterial pet wipe and starting to clean your dog's feet when you come in. So if you have a long-coated breed like a Yorkshire Terrier that is in full coat, then it might be a little more difficult. But for most people, it just means that we should start cleaning our dog's feet off, because what's going to happen then is at least we're not bringing in all those contaminants into the house. Now, granted, it comes in on your shoes as well, but chances are that by the time it comes in on your shoes, it's dry already, versus with the dog's feet, it's a naturally great place for any kind of a bacteria to grow, because their feet can be damp, especially if it's wet outside. So you definitely want to get all the way up into the pads, clean off their feet as best you can, because otherwise what can happen is they come inside and a lot of dogs will actually start licking their feet, right, to clean themselves off. And they just came in from outside, and they've got bacteria. It can be all kinds of things, from Giardia, Coccidia, even worms that they can get. So you definitely want to consider, especially particularly in this very wet weather, where you're kind of cleaning the dog's feet off. Now, some other things that you want to do is make sure, and I know we go through this every year, please make sure you don't take your dog in the car and leave your dog in the car. People think, oh, well, I'm only going to be gone for 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, even if it's only 70 degrees, which is a pretty comfortable temperature, even if you crack your windows, it can still rise to well over 110 degrees and even higher, which can cause your dog to pant, to, you know, be under stress, and can actually kill your dog. They can get heat stroke pretty quickly. So if you have a dog that you're planning on taking into a place like a Home Depot or something where dogs are allowed, but your stop also includes the supermarket, and thankfully, hopefully you're not one of those people who's faking a dog to be a service dog. You know, if the dog is going to be in the car with the car, you know, off for any period of time at all, and I'm saying a minute or more, even to run into the post office. I've seen people tie their dogs up outside or leave their car off with the windows cracked a little and go into the post office and say, oh my God, I didn't know it was going to be such a long line. So you really have to think about it before you create these problems. Don't assume that, you know, you're going to be in there for 2 seconds and it's going to be quick. Instead, I want you to assume that you're going to have a problem and that you're going to be a lot longer than you anticipated. I mean, we've seen that happen in parking lots where people actually leave their toddlers and babies in the car and just forget about them. So, you know, we all get sidetracked, and that's all fine. It's part of being a human, but let's not let our dogs have a problem with that. So, you know, the other thing that I've seen lately is people leaving their dog in the car because it's raining and it's supposedly, you know, very cloudy. So they're like, oh, it's fine. It can still get heated up very high. But how about if you're inside and you're not paying attention and the sun comes out and now your dog is in danger? So why would you do that? So let's start thinking about it from their perspective. Would your dog rather be in a hot car waiting for you to return, or would he rather be in his own comfortable house that's climate controlled and air conditioned, where he's lying on his bed and he's just hanging out? You know, I hate to say it, but most dogs would rather be on their bed at home with, you know, a Kong or a bone to chew on, and they'd be much, much happier there and safer. It's just it takes one time, you know. It's there's unfortunately a lot of times these things happen, and you know, you just can't take it back once it's happened. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So that's what I do want to talk about as far as for safety wise for today's show. Now, along the lines of what do dogs like, I think that this weather is just perfect to go out and get you up early and go out, take your dog out for a nice walk. If you have a dog who's got a lot of energy, you know, we talk about how to walk. And what I'm going to start doing again is I know that was one of our favorite things in our series was talking about how to get your dog to walk well on a leash and how to actually just get your dog to behave well. That's what I do. I'm a canine behaviorist. I'm not an obedience trainer. I'm not somebody local who says, "Oh yeah, well, 2 years ago, I owned a bakery, and now I'm a dog behaviorist or a dog trainer." Or, you know, 3 years ago, I was a financial planner, and now, you know, I'm self-taught. You know, I've got the scars on my arms to prove how much I've done. And you know, when you start out, it takes 5 to 10 years if you're doing, let's say, 6, 8, 10 dogs a day. It takes that long because you have to get used to every single dog. Just because something worked on one dog once or worked on 10 dogs once doesn't mean that it's going to work on every dog. So you have to be able to look at things and have contingency plans. You have to understand if this doesn't work, don't keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. That's a definition of insanity. So I'm going to give you, starting this week, we're going to go through the chapters of my book. I've written a lot of books. I want to give you the name. This is called Shh Happens, SHHH Happens, Dog Behavior 101 by Janice Wolf. And you'll see our illustrious Wyatt on the front cover laying there with, it's a really cute picture. He's so adorable. And he is actually laying here right now in the studio with me, with his sister Wispity Bunny Dog, who was named 10 years ago by my viewers. So it's pretty cool. So let's talk about that. So what do dogs need? All right. At United Canine Pros, which is United, the letter K, the number 9, pros, pros.com, UnitedCaninePros.com, what we wind up doing is fielding issues and fielding problems that most local trainers couldn't handle. Now, if you get an honest trainer, and I'm not knocking trainers, I'm just saying, hey, if you're doing training, you're obedience trainer, please don't tell people who have a dog with a behavioral issue that it's the worst thing you ever saw and that they should euthanize their dog or give it up because you don't have that expertise. If I went in and I had a diagnosis of a brain tumor and I went into a doctor and the doctor said, "Oh my gosh, I don't know. I've never seen something this bad. You better go home. You're going to die." I would not accept that. I would go for a second opinion, perhaps a third and fourth opinion. That's what normally happens with people who contact us at United Canine Pros. They're very rarely contacting us because they have an initial issue. It's usually that they've had a couple of trainers, maybe even had the dog on Prozac or some kind of medication, which Prozac, by the way, is not a great idea for the vast majority of dogs because it can release their inhibitions and then they can actually become more aggressive. But you have to think like a dog. If training isn't working, then it's not a training issue. I don't care how good your trainer is. And there are some fantastic trainers. We have some in United Canine Pros who people who started out as obedience trainers and still compete. The question is when it's a behavioral issue and you're just using food or cookies or clickers or whatever, and then the crazy shock collar people who insist that it's an e-collar and it doesn't hurt. You know, I'm sorry about that, but you know, you can use a training collar, but if that's your first modality, then you're not a good person or a good trainer because that should never be your first line of defense. If that's the only tool you've got in your toolbox, then you need to get into another field. If you think that you can take a hammer And when you need a Phillips head screwdriver, and you think that you can just make the hammer work by just beat the screw into it instead of getting a screwdriver, you're probably in the wrong field. Animals don't follow what we want. They follow patterns, but you still have to be able to understand what that pattern is and how that pattern can be changed by having an intelligent behaviorist who's truly a behaviorist. And by the way, we are always looking for people who are looking to have this as a career who we can train to become canine behaviorists. We have a school, an academy that we work. It's through United Canine Professionals, which is unitedcaninepros.com. And we can actually teach you. But, you know, the whole concept about if it doesn't work and you keep doing the same thing over and over again and it's still not working or the behavior is intensifying, you know, if it's not getting better, go do something different. Like my husband always used to say, do something different, even if it's wrong, do something. Because if it's not working, try something else. This is where you see a rat in a maze, and you know the rat's not very bright because it keeps trying to go through the same wall that it hasn't gotten through the last 50 times. Go to a different direction, turn around and go somewhere else. And if your trainer or the person saying that they're a behaviorist can't help you, and it's the worst thing they've ever seen, or I don't know, or they're trying and it's months and you still don't see any progress, assume that you need to go somewhere else. If the brain tumor isn't getting better, go to a different doctor. If your dog is not having any improvement, or if there are serious issues, significant issues, you need to find someone else. And any good dog trainer or you know, wannabe behaviorist is going to tell you flat out, listen, this is a really bad situation. Well, when they start saying that, you need to run and go find somebody who knows what to do. And that's where you can call us at 855-449-9288. 855-449-9288. It's actually 855, the number 4, the letter K, the number 9, and then PROS, P-R-O-S spelled out. And we'll help you. We'll actually give you a free consultation on the phone. So we'll see if it is something that we feel your local trainer can handle. And there's some phenomenal local trainers around. You just have to determine if it is a behavioral issue or if it's a training issue. If it's a training issue, then you go to somebody who's a trainer who's going to sit with you and is going to come back every week, or you're going to meet them every week for classes. That's typically how that's done. But a person who's claiming expertise in behavior should not be giving cookies, should not be giving, you know, should not be using clickers, should not ever be using any aversives like shock collars or doing things like, you know, throwing things at the dog. Like there's one group of people who does that. Why would you throw things at a dog? You're trying to build trust in the dog. So don't do that. But if it doesn't feel right, or if you say to yourself, gee, I don't see a difference and I've just spent $2,000 on lessons, you're probably dealing with a behavioral issue and you need to go to a behaviorist. So now that I'm off of that tirade, I'm going to go on to my next rant, which is, how do you help your dog? And how do you know if it's working? How do you know when you're dealing with a trainer or a local behaviorist or even a veterinary behaviorist, which are veterinarians that use medication to try to mitigate some of the issues? The key is, if you don't see a difference, like my good friend Dr. Temple Grandin always says, just if you're taking chances with something and you don't see a benefit, then it's not worth taking the chance. So if you're working with a trainer or someone who, with your dog, and you notice like, wow, it just seems to be getting worse, you need to seek out a behaviorist. And a behaviorist doesn't need to be a veterinarian. A veterinary behaviorist is a veterinarian who then studies behavior of all different kind of animals, and many of them don't really get into the down and dirty like I do and our people do as far as getting, you know, I get bitten sometimes. Well, I'm dealing with dogs who've bitten, you know, 10 people before I walk in the door, and the dog might bite me, and I don't care. I don't care because I'm there to save the dog. And if I lose, that dog may die. That dog may have to be put to sleep. If I win and I can teach that dog, then the dog lives. So it's a pretty easy decision there on my part. But you do have to really interview people. And actually, if you look at Wyatt's List, which I talk about frequently, it's a phenomenal website, wyattslist.com, W-Y-A-T-T-S-L-I-S-T.com. On Wyatt's List, you'll actually see PDF files you can download that will list the questions you should ask of your veterinarian, should ask of your trainer, should ask of your behaviorist. You should ask of a boarding facility or a training center and all these different places, even a pet sitter, doggy daycare. You should be interviewing people. They want your money. That the least they can do is answer some questions. And if they seem like they don't want to answer or they're bothered, they're probably not going to be the people who are going to take responsibility when something happens. So, you know, this is like sending your kid away to sleepaway camp. And again, don't send your dog off to these board and train. Chances are the either you guys are creating it or you know, maybe exacerbating it. And if it's a dog who has chemical issues, or the dog, you know, is a rescue. You didn't create it, but you have the power. You are the only ones who can fix it. So if the dog goes away and somebody's zapping it with a shock collar and it comes back and you go, wow, look, he's not aggressive anymore, but he's not like my dog. He's like he had a frontal lobotomy. That's what happens. We want to keep the personality of the dog. We don't want the dog to change the good things that you like. We just want to get rid of the things you don't like. So you don't want to start zapping the dog, and you don't want to start medicating him so he's just a drugged up, like you think of a junkie on the streets. You want your dog like that? You might as well not have the dog. The dog might as well not be alive if he's going to have a life like that. So make sure you take into consideration what feels right. Get recommendations, and when you start seeing people who are obviously constantly on a group and like on a Facebook group, they're constantly saying, oh, you should try this person, you should try this person. You know what winds up happening? It's somebody, maybe it's the guy's girlfriend or cousin or, you know, somebody there who is trying to get them business. You know, my name shows up all the time. And you know what? On the phone, I help people for free and they can never believe it. They're like, well, why would you do it for free? I said, because I can. I can't come to your house and spend hours for free, but I'll help you. And I work with so many rescues and shelters, and I'm recommended by so many veterinarians and even obedience and other kind of trainers, because I can fix what nobody else can fix. And I'm going to teach you how to do that. It's not that I'm just so wonderful. It's that I'm super experienced and I learned. The reason I have been bitten so many times is not because I'm not good. It's because I'm better now at what I do than I was 20 or 30 years ago. And that should be the way it is. So when you first start out and you're working with aggressive dogs and you say, oh, I've never been bitten, you haven't worked with bad dogs. You think you have, but you don't know, because if you're not bitten, you're going to get bitten. You're going to have, you know, blood all over the floor, and you're going to have chunks of your, you know, your leg or your arm or, you know, bites on your hand and wrist. You're going to have that. It's like if you ride horses enough or if you ski enough, eventually you're going to fall down. You're going to get hurt. Doesn't mean you're not great at what you do, but that's how you learn not to do it again. So let's go through for today the concept of what you need. Do you need a trainer or do you need a behaviorist? Well, if you have a good dog, the dog doesn't have aggression issues, the dog doesn't have separation anxiety, the dog doesn't have, you know, a lot of issues where it's constantly marking territory, you're probably in very good hands with your local obedience trainer. Find out, though, from other people who have a similar dog. Don't say, oh, yeah, I went to Joe Schmo's, you know, dog training school with my Rottweiler, and they did, you know, this really rough training, and it worked great, and now you're going to go send your greyhound there. Totally different dog. You have to look at the breed and group. So the breed of the dog or the combination of breeds and the group to which that dog belongs, hound, working, herding, etc. Because that's the issue. Every dog is different, like every child is different. You can be a teacher with 30 years of experience with pre-K kids, and you're an expert on that. But you get a teenager who slugs the teacher, and you're going to be an expert on that? No, you're not. How about an inner city kid? Or how about a kid from a very high socioeconomic background who's, you know, doing heroin or something, or doing, oxycodone? You're going to be able to deal with that when you're used to 2 and 3 year olds? No. You have to find and treat the different dogs and the different situations and children and people as they are different. They're not the same. And that's where we get into finding someone, not who's just available, but someone who genuinely is experienced and understands your breed. Now, I breed Grand Champion Rhodesian Ridgebacks, and Mike here has been winning a lot. She's phenomenal right now, and she's winning pretty much everything. And people are constantly saying, wow, you know, she's so beautiful, and, you know, is that why she's winning? I said, no, she's winning because she loves food. Most Ridgebacks they're not super food motivated, and either they are extremely food motivated or not at all. And I have a pretty good mix. Now, Kira, who is Grand Champion, I think she's silver, Rambo's, Wyatt's, Kira in charge. Kira just loves food. She's beautiful, but the dog loves to eat. She's like a Labrador Golden with that, and with regard to that. So with Kira, you can go anywhere. Plus, she's a super stable dog. She's a Wyatt daughter. She's gorgeous. She's just, from a show perspective, she's stunning. But what makes her such a great show dog isn't just how she looks. It's the fact that she loves to show off and she loves to eat. So you show her a piece of liver, she'll jump through fire for it. But you take another dog who's the same breed, who's not food motivated, which I have, like, for instance, Wyatt. He never liked to eat food when he was showing. So I had to find other ways. And a lot of my Ridgebacks are not super food driven. So I had to find other ways to communicate with them to get them to be a little more up and to be happy in the ring. So you have to be able to adjust. Pretty much, I call it catch riding or catch handling. If you ride a horse, like let's say you ride the same horse or you have only your dog over and over and over every single day, you get really good at one dog or one horse or one individual. So you need to expand. So even if you have the best dog in the world and you say, well, I did a great job with my dog, good. Go out and get around, volunteer at a good shelter, volunteer with a rescue. You don't have to foster, but volunteer, get around other dogs. It's going to expand your horizons. That's what we do at United Canine Pros. We are constantly expanding people. We're trying to take what you have naturally in you and help you to develop that. So once you start doing it, you start realizing, and I always have a phrase, you don't know what you don't know. And it's like people will, you know, say, oh, I have three dogs, and they're like, they're perfectly behaved. And they know they're perfectly trained, because what you're not seeing is how they're barking, how they have separation anxiety. But yeah, for a cookie, they're going to be, you know, doing whatever, you know, task you're training them to do. They're going to do that body position, but they're not going to be a service dog. They're not going to be automatic. They're not going to think on their own. I love dogs to be independent thinkers. I think it's the coolest thing in the world. When you actually take a dog and the dog is able to just do it automatically. I've trained over 1,000 service dogs and through Merlin's kids. And we're going to talk about that in a little while. But I think the thing I'm most proud of with all these dogs is the fact that they go into their new families and we make sure that we have a nice solid bond. And then we train with the families for over a year after placement. And we do a 16-week training course where they have to learn how to use the dog. We have them, and then we go to their homes, and I'll talk about that later as well. But The reason that it works so well is because we teach the humans. The dog doesn't just know what to do. I mean, we can train the dog to get a beer out of the refrigerator for your six-year-old. But if you don't need your six-year-old to be drinking a beer, but maybe dad wants the beer, we need to train dad, teach dad how to implement that task and how to teach the dog what you want it to do and teach you the commands or the signals. Or better yet, how about if the dog just knows almost automatically, almost seemingly automatic, where the dog knows what to do? Think of a dog that's going to be going out with you, and let's teach the dog that when we get in the car, we sit calmly. Don't train him. Don't constantly reward him, and don't constantly reprimand him. Catch him when he's doing something the right way. And that's where you want to reinforce it. It's what I used to do with horses. I would wait until one of the horses would be in that body position that I wanted. And my one who comes to mind is my Reba, who's one of my Lipizzan stallions. And Reba is very spooky. In other words, he is not a brave kind of a horse. And he's super athletic and can do all the airs above ground, which means he can kind of, you know, stand up on his back legs. He can jump with all 4 feet off the ground, kick his front and back legs out. I do all those airs above ground with my Lipizzan. So, you know, you take like Reba. Reba used to dump everybody. People would think, oh, I know how to ride. I go, here, go ride Reba. Reba would see something and spook and take off, and people would fall off, and I'd be like, okay, well, there you go. And they go, wow, I've never had a horse like that do that to me. I'm like, yes, because you've ridden, you know, lesson horses and, you know, horses that are basically just, you know, plug horses. But when you get around horses or dogs who have different kind of backgrounds, different breeds, different types, different personalities, that's when you start learning. So you want to actually find a trainer or a behaviorist and make sure they are behaviorists and make sure that the trainers do have some sort of, you know, training in them, and that you know somebody else who's got a similar dog, better yet, you know, many of the same types of dogs. And then find that person and interview that person. You can go on Wyatt's List. Remember, wyattslist.com. You can go on Wyatt's List and get that information. And you can download it, and then you'll ask them questions. They'll be happy. If they're legit, they're going to be really happy because they're going to be proud of what they've done. Some obedience trainers and, you know, local trainers are really great. You know, they put a lot of time in. You may not really know them. They might not do, you know, 40 dogs a week. They're not making their name. You know, everything is their name, their name, their name. But they're genuinely interested in, you know, making sure that they do a good job for you. And those are the people you want. Don't worry about the name you heard. You speak with these people on the phone. You interview them. And when you get somebody who says, well, I'm very proud, you know, I've done, you know, 120 dogs, which, God, I can do that in like a month. But I've done 120 dogs. And out of those 109 of those dogs, I was able to help. The other 11 I referred to a behaviorist. That's what I want to hear. I want to hear that you did a great job, but on the ones you couldn't fix, that you were kind of, they were a little, they say, as above your pay grade, you were professional enough and responsible enough and caring enough about those people and those dogs that you referred them to somebody you trusted who had a different skill set, different tools in their toolbox. So I think that's something that you have to really give consideration to. And also just remember, when you're working with a dog, don't expect it instantly. People always say, when I walk in their house, within seconds, they say, wow, my dog's never done that before, or my dog always does this. Why isn't he jumping on you? Why isn't he trying to bite you? He's bitten the last 9 people who came in the house. Because I'm doing it differently. If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, guess what? That's insanity. So you want to look for someone who's open-minded, and you also want to look for someone who's not afraid to say, hey, I don't know. You want that person who cares more about your dog and you than about money in his or her pocket or feeling that they're not good enough. Well, you know what, if you feel that way, that you're intimidated, then that shows a major personality flaw. If you're intimidated because somebody knows something that you don't know, that's dangerous. That's like what we call actually a malignant narcissist. That someone who thinks that nobody can know more than I do, that's dangerous. Now, it doesn't mean you don't know a lot, because heck, I know more than most people I've ever spoken with. And I have long conversations with my friend Temple Grandin all the time. And she's always joking. She says, I don't know why you want to go for your PhD. You've already got, every time I sit down with you, I give you another master's degree. And I love it because I'm constantly learning, but I'm at a point where I have to learn from people like her, because there aren't many people up there who've done as many things as I've been blessed to have done. So if I don't know something about a child with autism, or if there's a question I have on a disability or on medication, or if I'm looking to work with a dog, I might ask her, as she will ask me. We were discussing a lot of this about the airplanes with, dogs getting on planes, quote unquote, service dogs, and then the real service dogs, and then the emotional support dogs, and all these different things. And we were discussing it, and she said, I wanted to talk to you. I want to see what you think about this. I want your opinion. Well, that makes me feel great, because she's amazing. And she wants my opinion, because she says that I know more about that field than she does, that particular question. So that's how you learn, though. Don't be afraid to ask. Don't ever be afraid to say, you know what, that's a great question. I've never been asked that question before. Let me check that out for you. Because that shows, as obviously nobody knows everything, as wicked smart as I could ever be, there's so much stuff I don't know. But you know what I do know? I know that if I'm not 100% sure about something, I check it out and I find it out. Because now I do know. Now I learn. So the next time that question comes up, I do know the answer. So let's talk about for a few minutes, and then we're going to take a little break. Let's just talk about things that you might want to do with your dog to kind of enjoy the weather, but not have the problems with, obviously, with the heat. If you have a basement that's maybe unfinished or a playroom for your kids, consider turning it into a fun place for your dog. Get some agility equipment. Agility's a blast. You can get, you don't have to get an A-frame or a teeter-totter, but get a tunnel and some jumps. Make sure that the flooring, the footing, is either carpet or you have some kind of mats so that the dog isn't going to jump and have to turn on a slippery, slick floor, like a hardwood floor or something that's got polish to it, or linoleum or marble. But find something with good footing. And for probably $50 or less, and you could probably even make some on your own. For a little bit of money, you can pick up a tunnel, couple of jumps, little table for the dog to sit or stand on, and you can have a lot of fun. So that's inside, so it's climate controlled. So if it rains, so if you have a high energy dog, like, you know, let's say like a sheepdog, a herding dog, German Shepherd, Malinois, something that's kind of high drive, high energy, even a lab, it's a great idea to do something in your home. Because this way, if it's a bad day, and especially with all the rain we've been having lately, it's great for you to be able to have a place where the dog can do fun stuff for him. Remember, and I always say this, when I go into the show ring, the confirmation show ring with my dogs, or I ask my dogs to go out with a handler, they're doing that for me. They're not loving it, although Kira really does love it. They're doing that for me. So I want to do stuff for them. I want my dogs to have fun. So if they can do a little agility, or we can do little games, even if you do a little bit of obedience training, even if you don't really care if you're ever competing, it's fun. Grab a bag of cookies, you know, give little pieces and make sure you don't make your dog fat. I call that obedience through obesity. So please, you know, make sure you count the caloric intake of the treat so you're not letting your dog get too overweight. But that's so much fun for the dog. Let his brain have some exercise. A lot of dogs don't really need as much exercise as you think. What they really need is mental stimulation, so they're able to kind of feel comfortable and, like, you know, kind of like you going to the gym and working out for an hour. You feel good afterwards. So think about that. And we're going to be back in just a moment with some wonderful tips on from shelter dog to service dog and working with your rescue dogs and puppies. We will be right back. Welcome back to For the Love of Dog with Janice Wolf and our segment on From Shelter Dog to Service Dog. So as promised, we're going to discuss today about how to handle a rescue dog or a puppy, especially one that you don't know about the background. Now, when people go to a pet store and they buy a dog and they say, oh, I felt bad, I was rescuing. Yeah, that's really not. And I do want to go into that for a minute and, you know, just kind of get everyone sad about it. You know, when you go in and you pick a puppy from any kind of, it doesn't matter. I don't care if they tell you, oh, so yeah, we only use the best top quality breeders. What are they going to do? Say, yeah, we go to puppy mills and get the dogs as cheap as possible. They're not going to tell you that. But anybody, a breeder, quote unquote breeder of purebred dogs who belongs to a parent breed club or even an AKC breed club is going to lose their membership if they sell to a pet store or sell online. There's a pretty strict code of ethics among legitimate, reputable breeders. So anybody who's breeding mixed breed dogs doesn't care. You're breeding dogs to make money. Just heard about somebody who started breeding, and it's just like a crazy. It's dachshund boxers. Now, I don't know who came up with that brilliant idea, but a dachshund and a boxer, kind of my question is why? Because dachshunds are great little dogs and boxers are fantastic. What would possess you? Like, you want to see what Frankenstein would have done? You want to call Mary Shelley and say, hey, Mary Shelley, I'm looking at making things that we have no idea what they're going to be. We have no idea the genetics. We have no idea about anything, the health or anything. I'm going to do that. By the way, Mary Shelley, if you look up, is the author of the Frankenstein series. So we're looking at dogs as listen, how many rescues there are? How many dogs are unwanted? And by the way, you can get any combination of breeds you want. If you want to get a poodle mix, there are a million rescues because a lot of people buy them and they're too hyper or they're out of control or they're aggressive or whatever, and they dump them into shelters and rescues. So if you want a breed that is low shedding, you can get one very inexpensively, because there are so many of them because they have a lot of genetic defects. But what starts happening is, again, like I was talking about earlier, you have to look at the breeds and the combination of breeds as what is this going to create? What exactly am I looking for? So when you have a dog and you go to a pet store and it's a mixed breed dog to start with, there is no oversight. There is no parent breed club. Like if you breed German Shepherds or you breed Rhodesian Ridgebacks or you breed poodles or you breed, you know, Labradors, whatever you could breed, whatever you're doing, there's a code. There's what we call a breed standard. And the breeds are bred for a specific purpose, a specific size, a specific hair coat, sometimes even a specific color. But when you start breeding just to make money and you start breeding things that are defects or genetically flawed, like certain color combinations, like, for instance, I know someone's going to probably complain, but I don't care. Silver Labs, They're not purebred labs. Something else had to happen. There's a change in the DNA. So a lot of those dogs, as gorgeous as they are, and they are beautiful, they're the color of a Weimaraner. But you know what? That defect, not in every individual, but in many individuals, causes temperament issues, health issues, tumors, a predisposition to certain genetic diseases. So why would we want to do that just to get a dog that's a little different color? Go with what's been tried and true for hundreds and hundreds of years by experts who care about the breed. So as soon as you go to a pet store, assume that somebody like myself, and I breed Grand Champion Rhodesian Ridgebacks, my dogs don't have health issues. My dogs don't have temperament issues. I follow up with these people for the rest of the dog's life, sometimes 15 or 16 years when my dogs are, I've long since, the people are thrilled, but I've long since, bred other litters, but I stand behind my litters. I stand behind my dogs. So why would I, as a very reputable Grand Champion show dog breeder, why would I give one of my dogs to a pet store for, let's say, $500 when the going rate, let's say, is $2,500, unless my dogs weren't good? Because I want to know where my dogs go to. I want to know who's going to buy them. I don't want to sell my dog to somebody who doesn't care and is just putting a puppy in a cage and couldn't care less who buys it as long as they've got the money. That's where the problem is. And the other issue is the people who, like myself, who care about where our dogs go. And don't tell me that if you're breeding mixed breed dogs that you really care that much, because guess what? If you're breeding mixed breed dogs and you're doing it and you're doing it for money and you keep breeding and breeding and breeding, knowing you have issues with your dogs, you know what? I won't say what you are, but you know what you are. So as soon as you walk into a pet store and somebody says, oh, and this was the funniest thing I've seen in a long time. I want a mini golden doodle. I want a mini golden doodle. Okay. Well, one client of mine, and I love her, she had a 70-pound, I can't call him that, 70-pound poodle golden mix that she paid like $4,000 for. So she said, oh, I want a small one this time. So I'm going to get a mini golden doodle because I want to get this one. I want it only to be 30 or 40 pounds. Her mini golden doodle grew to be 110 pounds. Okay? 110 pounds. And she said, but the father was, 12 pounds and the mother was like 50 pounds. How is it possible for this dog, this puppy of those two parents to be 110 pounds? And I mean tall, like Wyatt's height, big, tall dog, looks like a little Great Pyrenees almost. And I said, because the way the DNA combines, you look at it, you can live in a family and be from a family who has zero people with blue eyes. But you know what? Great great grandma and great great grandpa on both sides, well, guess what? They were what you call heterozygous dominant, like for brown eyes would be capital B, little b, capital B, little b. So 25% chance they can get blue-eyed baby. So guess what? If you have a great grandparent who's very tall, even though everybody else is short, if it's on both sides, it's incomplete dominance. You can have a tiny one, you can have a huge one, you can have anything in between. And that's where the problem is, because you're breeding things that have not stayed in a standard. There is no standard for these mixed breed dogs. People are just breeding them to get money. And that's fine. If you want to make money, go do something. Stand behind your dog. Just today, I was actually talking with someone who has a, I don't know, it's one of the poodle mixes. I don't remember what the other half is, but they're very commonly going to have issues like health issues, temperament issues, even some really serious aggression. And I do remember nobody calls me and says, hey, Janice, I got the best dog in the world. Can you come visit? And they're always calling me that they bought this dog. The quote unquote breeder says, well, I've never had another one ever with a problem with a temperament like that. That's BS. That's ridiculous because you're breeding mixes. You're not going to have any consistency, even within a litter. I've seen litters where one was 22 pounds and the other one is 70 pounds. Same parents, same litter. So, you know, that's what happens. And it doesn't mean that because nothing's happened before that it's not going to happen again. That's why I always say past performance is no guarantee of future results. So you really don't know what you're getting. So then that brings us to please don't buy mixed breed dogs at pet stores. Please don't buy any kind of purebred dog at pet stores because you're not rescuing that dog. If you didn't buy that dog at that pet store, they're going to lose money on that dog. And you know what's going to wind up happening? They're going to stop doing business because they're only making money because everybody goes in and feels sorry for these adorable little puppies in cages. Don't contribute to the problems that are plaguing us right now with these mixed breed designer dogs. It's not that the dogs are bad, and you can get a great one. You can get five great ones, but for those five great ones, there may be two or three that you don't know about that end up in a shelter or end up with horrible defects, megaesophagus, or genetic, like chromosomal issues, you know, Addison's disease, Cushing's, you know, thyroid issues, hip issues, dysplasia, like you can't even believe. So this is where at some point you have to say to yourself, you know what? I want a Grand Champion Show Dog line, even though I'm not going to show it. And you go to a reputable breeder and you know what? You may have to wait a year to get a puppy. That's good. That means that everybody wants those dogs. I've had people wait 2.5 years to get one of my puppies. When I told them other good breeders that I trust, they said, no, we want one of yours. So I love when that happens because it shows me that the owners are committed and they really care about getting a really well-bred dog that's not going to have genetic issues, not going to have temperament issues. I'm going to stand behind that dog for the entire dog's life and it's going to be great. But then you have people who are going to pet stores and buying dogs, and the more dogs and puppies you're buying from these pet stores, the more these crazy people are going to mix a beagle and a Shar Pei and call it a walrus. And yeah, they're cute. You know how many neck issues and back issues and temperament issues? Why would you do that? That's like Hitler. That's like Brave New World, 1984, a really Brave New World. So why are we doing that? If you want a dog and you don't need to have a Grand Champion Show line and you're not worried about having the best bred dog in the world and you're not going to a very good reputable AKC show breeder of merit, if you're not doing that, then go to the rescues. Don't have to only go to shelters. A lot of these rescues, there are poodle mix rescues. There are shepherd rescues. There are lab rescues. There are Ridgeback rescues, although there are never really any too many in there. There are all kinds of rescues, Minpins, Yorkies, Shelties. Pick your breed. Pick your combination of breeds. What's great about going to one of these local breed rescues is, or a foster-based, good kind of small to medium-sized rescue, is that the people know a history. Even though they might not know everything, there's somebody who's had that dog in their house or somebody who's been knowledgeable and has tried to keep up on it and is doing the right thing for the right reason. So if you perhaps are looking for a mini golden doodle, what you can do before you go and spend $4,000 on a very expensive mutt from a puppy mill, even though the people might seem lovely, they're doing it for money, and that is not a good reason to ever do something just because of the money. So you can go online. You can look up on some of the pet search websites, and you can actually Google and go on, or you can even go on Wyatt's List, wyattslist.com. We have a lot about that with rescues and breeders and how to find certain dogs. But there's great thing is that's where social media is actually helpful. Put it out there and say, hey, I'm looking for a poodle mix. I'm looking for a beagle or a beagle mix. And you'll have people sharing that, and you'll find a dog who needs a home who maybe never even made it to a shelter or rescue. You'll know who the owner was. You'll know exactly why the person had to get rid of the dog. Sometimes people just can't keep a dog. They lose a job. They can't keep the dog. And there are plenty like that. But there are also people who bought a dog and found the dog was aggressive, or the dog had behavioral issues and or health issues. And either they couldn't or didn't want to follow through on it, and they needed to give the dog up. But at least you'll know. And you're saving a dog. You're preventing somebody from putting another puppy into a cage. And you're also, which is, I think, the best thing, you're saving a life instead of causing another life to be born in a hellhole. We've all seen these, like Just for Pups and some of these other places that have been shut down with tons of dogs, hundreds of dogs. And there are people out there who sell to, you know, puppymill.com, and they're like, oh, you know, no, we only use the best breeders. Yeah, well, the one, my friend bought a Boston Terrier. I won't say the name of the company, but it was one of these, like, I joke, puppymill.com places. And they said, we only go to the finest AKC show breeders. Really? Well, when I look at the papers on the dog, I even question whether it's a purebred dog, because the papers are only as good as the paper they're written on, and you can, you know, what you can do with that paper. So you're taking a dog who potentially is, you know, a problem or has bad genetics, and these people are selling them, and then these other people broker the puppies. Well, the puppy comes to us, and I got the phone number of the woman and I, who was the quote unquote breeder. And I said, geez, that's awesome. You're a breeder. What kind of dogs you breed? She had four different breeds she bred, which was the first thing. When people are breeding, two breeds is one. I breed one. Most reputable breeders breed one. Sometimes you'll have a reputable breeder breeding two. But if they're not showing their dogs and you don't see them all grand champions, you want to run the other way. Now, why do you want to run the other way? Because when people start breeding four breeds and interbreeding four breeds, you got a puppy mill. So I said to the woman, well, how many Boston Terriers do you have? How many, you know, brood bitches do you have? She said, well... and I asked how many litters she does a year. She says, well, I don't breed every one of my females on every single heat. So, you know, because you have to give them time to rest. And I'm waiting for this brilliant excuse for a human being who doesn't even know, because she's got six of her own kids. So maybe, you know, there should be contraception in the house in more ways than one. She said to me, I only have 9 males, but I have 47 Boston bitches who I breed, but I don't breed them each on every heat cycle. So figure, even if once a year she breeds them, or she breeds 3 cycles and then gives them one off, she's breeding hundreds and hundreds of puppies a year. If she's breeding 40, let's say 40 bitches constantly every 6 months, that's 240 litters potentially in a 2-year period. That's crazy. So in a 6-year period, she's producing 1,000, 2,000 puppies. And do you think she cares if they're going to a family who's going to be good? No, they don't care. They're just looking for money. That was mortifying for me. I don't know one single reputable AKC show breeder or show breeder of merit. Not one single one who owns 47 breeding females. That's crazy. That's absolutely nuts. So if you're looking for a particular breed or combination of breeds, you can go to the shelter. And great thing about the animal shelter is that when you go to the animal shelters, and depending on which one, you get to see dogs that, like, they're really cool looking. I love going to the shelters and even the rescues, and I look and I go, oh my gosh, I've never seen a dog who looks like this. Look how cool this dog looks. There's one of that dog. You're not looking at, oh, is that a mini golden doodle or is that a labradoodle or is that a cockapoo or is it, because they all look the same, because it means they don't look at all alike. You can't tell what they are. But when you say, oh, wow, is that a well-bred German Shepherd? Is that a well-bred Dutch Malinois? Is that a well-bred Rhodesian Ridgeback? Is that a well-bred Chihuahua? You should be able to look at it and say, wow, that's a nice looking dog. But that's the problem when you go to these puppy mills and these people who are breeding just for money. They don't care what these dogs look like when they grow up. They don't care how big they are. They don't care if they have issues because, you know, for every time you're doing things, you've got to make sure that these dogs are, you know, going to be healthy and have great temperaments. I promise to be on another rant and another tirade next week. Please refer to wyattslist.com for any information you'd like. And contact us at United Canine Pros, 1-855-449-9288, for any information you might need on dogs and all, and of course, merlinskids.org. We'll see you next week. Hope everybody has a great, happy, healthy, and dry weekend. Take care.